thank you very much, Rabbi Brand, for that beautiful overstatement. I do appreciate that. The world class is a reach, certainly. But the fact that I have been in Eretz Yisrael a number of times would take care of that, perhaps. Jonathan Rosenblum, Yonatan Rosenblum, who actually is a Chicagoan, has come out with a new book on the great one of the great shtadlanim of our time, one of the great Jewish leaders working with governmental officials, working with the general population, Rav Moshe Scherer of blessed memory. It's a large, thick book, and he begins the book, actually, Yonatan Rosenblum, begins the book, but with a quote from the Alter from Slobodka, of the Nosson Tzvi Finkel. And he says, in matters of tshuva, it is not enough to be better. One must change. The Alter's view, it appears to me, is a statement that to do tshuva, gemura, meaning to say complete tshuva. Tshuva in itself, certainly, I would imagine, I can't speak for the Alter, but I would imagine that he's not saying that unless tshuva is an all or nothing proposition. Do everything or it's nothing. But what he's saying is if one really wants to see himself, herself, become a Baal tshuva, zot umeret, to become the master of tshuva, then it is not sufficient to make our changes incremental and stop. But rather, tshuva is a difference not in degree, but in kind. That the Baal tshuva is a person who is not merely a person who is better than she was yesterday, better than he was a month ago, but they are, in a meaningful sense, changed. Today we're going to discuss three great personalities in Tanakh. I entitled this particular lecture "Turning Points: Pivotal Moments in the Lives of Three Biblical Heroes, Yehuda, Moshe, and David." And so, therefore, what I'd like you to do is to turn. There's two things. Number one, I do have the sheet which I had given, and it was. I very much appreciate your preparing it, and I also don't want to forget. How appreciative I am of the Kollel to ask me to speak today. One never takes that for granted, and one is always appreciative of, number one, the very great work that the Kollel does in the community in every aspect, and number two, that I should be able to speak before you and share some thoughts. The first person we're going to discuss today is Yehuda. Now, of course, within the thinking of the Baalei Tanakh, our Parshanim, and Chazal, and even modern day today, where there are two views about the great biblical personalities. One is that they really are at a level which is, they are different in kind from us. Not just different in degree. Different in kind. And what you think is a sin, and what is even delineated in the Torah as a sin, is not a sin like you and I do. But it's perhaps a fall from their level. The second view is, with reverence, that in fact they were subject to the foibles and the pitfalls that we are. Because if not, then there's nothing I can learn from them. If there is no connection between me and them, then I can't learn from them. The fact that perhaps a robot never makes a mistake is no inspiration to me. I do not aspire then to be a robot. But if there are human beings who fail, at whatever level that failure is, and then they change and are transformed, that can serve for me as an inspiration. And hopefully for you as well. So I'm going to actually, the major part of today's discussion will be about Yehuda and his transformation. As you know, of course, he was a leading figure in the sale of Yosef. And whether or not the brothers physically sold Yosef or whether they what they did was set the stage for it is also the subject of some debate. But one thing is certain, Yehuda's role is central. And so, therefore, I'll refer you to the first page, which has the title Yehuda. Yosef comes after, of course, a very, very troubling period of time between the brothers, more than just simple sibling rivalry. It descended to a matter of hatred, and we see that Yosef, for some inexplicable reason, is sent by his father 50, 60 miles north, alone, to see how his brothers, who are 11 or 10, are doing, to see how well they're doing. He's one. And of course, Chazal deal with that as well. Perhaps this is God's personal intervention in getting Yaakov to do something that no father, let alone Yaakov Avinu, would have done. But for another time. Please take a look at Pasuk Chavav. As the brothers see Yosef approach, we see that the Torah tells us, "Vayomer Yehuda elechav, ma betza ki nahrog et achim." What profit is there in selling our brother? Betza, Rashi says, cites the midrashic view, mamon. Simple. There's nothing to be gained in the killing of Yosef. You'll have no brother, and you'll have no money. Now, of course, we could argue that you have to know who you're talking to. You're talking about people who are enraged, people who are angry, people who, for whatever the circumstances, harbor tremendous ill will to their brother. And perhaps what Yehuda is doing is he's talking to the audience. He himself doesn't believe it. But I'd like to ask of you today to suspend that thought. By the way, it doesn't speak so well of the brothers, even if it speaks so well of you. It speaks well of Yehuda. Let's suspend that for a moment and say that he means it. Ma betzah ki nahrog et achinu. There is nothing, literally nothing, to be gained. V'chisinu et damo. And then we hide his blood, because, of course, we are somehow going to have to explain this to Papa. Not going to be so simple. L'chu v'nim kerenu la'yishma'ilim. I have an out for us. Let's sell him to the Yishma'ilim. V'yadenu. Now, I have underlined words, and when they're double underlined, you're going to note that they will be recurring. V'yadenu altivo, our hand, meaning to say our negative intentions and our negative actions will not be used against him, at least in their full force. Ki achinu v'sarenu hu v'yishmu echav. His brothers listen to him. Right? Now, then what they do is, again, how Yosef is sold, whether it is the brothers who actually lift him from the pit or whether it is the Midyanim who lift him from the pit is secondary, but the plan is carried out. That's certain. The plan is carried out. And the brothers come in Pasuk Lamed Bet, Vayishalchu et ktonet hapasim vayaviyu al avihem vayomru zot matzanu. We found this. Again, notice the double underlined word, hakerna. Identify this, please, as if it were, God forbid, as is happening on a daily basis in Haiti. Hakirna. Identify, please, this body. Can you? If you can, then perhaps we can bring it to burial. If not, he'll be buried somewhere else. Hakirna. But there has to be a certain detachment. There's a detachment in that word. Hakirna. Na doesn't even necessarily mean please. It could simply be now. Hakatonet bin chahim lo. Now notice what Yaakov's response is. Vayakira. He recognized it. What did he recognize? The coat. Okay. Vayomer katonet b'ni. It is my son's coat. And then he draws the conclusion that Yosef was killed by an animal because the brothers had. It appears, at least according to the Ramban and others, that the word vayishalachu does not just only mean send to send the coat, but the word it comes from the Hebrew word shelach, which is another word for sword. They They literally tore it into shreds. They shredded it. Vayishalachu. They took the verb itself of the noun shelach has turned into a verb. They literally tore it into many, many pieces by way of a sword, so that it looked like he was killed by an animal. And of course, then we see the next words, Vayimahein lehitnachem. He refused to be comforted. Adka. And of course, then Yosef is sent down. And of course, the main problem we have with this, the big question we have to ask is, why everybody wants to know immediately after this is what happened to Yosef, and what do we find right after this? Tamar and Yehuda. What happens to Yehuda? Yehuda, who here appears to be certainly the villain to some degree, maybe not even more than his brothers, because after all, it's his plot that is carried out. So we find not what happened to Yosef, but what happened to Yehuda. Now, I'd like to ask you, if you have not received, anybody who hasn't received this, I have plenty of them. Despite the fact that Rabbeinu Ibn Ezra takes the position, that actually Yehuda... Rabbi Angel is not only going to give lectures, also going to serve as the distributor. All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Rabbeinu Ibn Ezra, you know, says that this story actually preceded the story of the sale, because to be able to fit the whole story of Yehuda and Tamar in, it's strained, to say the least. However, it appears that the Bereshit Rabbah that we look at here does not seem to feel that. I have three objectives in showing you this beautiful piece by the Medrash that we have in the Medrash Rabbah. I'm going to read it with you, and then I have three objectives here. One is directly to do with what we're learning, and then there's a little something. Then there are two that are so beautiful that I can't pass them up. Vayhi ba'et ahi Rabbi Yishmo bar Nachman patach. Vayhi ba'et ahi is how the next parak begins. It was at that time, all right? Yehuda and Rabbi Yishmo bar Nachman begins, ki ani yadati et amachshavot. He quotes Yirmiyahu and Avi. Ani, of course, is God, says, I know the thinking of man. I know all the inner thoughts. And then the Medrash says, puts the words, so to speak, either in God's mouth, but it's probably much more sort of speaking about how this plays out according to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shvatim hayu asukim b'mechirato shel Yosef. The tribe, the brothers, were all involved. Asuk means to become involved in something. Notice, the word asuk is beinoni pa'ul. It is in a passive sense. The brothers were engaged in the selling of Yosef. The Yosef haya asuk b'sakov tanito. Yosef, of course, was deep in mourning, his own fate. Ruvain, says the Medrash, haya asuk b'sakov tanito. Here's a person who, certainly in the eyes of, despite again his flawed characters, we all have, nevertheless, his love of family unity certainly is hard to deny. Ruvain haya asuk b'sakov tan. Where am I going to go now? What's going to happen? He's overwhelmed. He is overcome. The Yaakov, of course, tells us clearly. Haya asuk b'sakov tanito. Yaakov was overwhelmed, overtaken with his mourning. Yehuda haya asuk likach isha. Hey, now is not a bad time to start looking together. The Medrash here paints a picture of a person who is very, very self-absorbed. Picture a family in complete mourning. Picture a family that, for whatever the reason, no matter the justification, has a brother that is clearly loved by the father, and perhaps that may be the reason, but nevertheless, no one who is reasonable and loving could say, well, I think things are okay, things are going okay. Yehuda decides it's time to get married. This might be a good opportunity for me. V'HaKadosh Baruch Hu haya, notice the phrase, Osek Borei Hoshav Melech HaMashiach. The Medrash, with one stroke, not only tells us why this particular parsha is listed here, as we will see in a few moments, all right, but it is to tell us also a theological truth. All of us are asukim. We are, you know, when we say ani asuk achshav, what does it mean? It means I can't deal with something that's important because I'm involved with something else that is controlling this aspect of my life right now. So say hu asuk means to say he or she is not going to be able to see you now. Why? Because they have a legitimate reason. They're doing something else. Human beings can't do two things at once, and therefore they're ani asuk. But the Bala Medrash realizes that only human beings are asukim. God is osek. God is active. God is not under the direction of this, but he is controlling and directing the actions. With one movement of a letter, the Bala Medrash masterfully tells us a theological statement that is beautiful. And secondly, of course, we see that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is indeed in control of everything. That's the theological truth. And shall we say the linguistic truth is in the movement of asuk and osek. And finally, of course, for our particular purpose, the message here is a second argument about self-absorption, thinking about oneself. The world around you is falling apart, and it's time for me to get some happiness into my life. Let's move back to the other. We'll come back to the sheet. Let's take a look now. We're going to analyze Perek Lamed Chet. Again, we're going to do it briefly because our time is relatively short. Now that the Medrash tells us why we have the positioning of it here, to tell us a bit about the character, the flawed character of Yehuda at this time of his life, the Torah tells us, "Vahi ba'it ahi va'yered Yehuda me'et chavayet ad ish adulami ushmo Chira." We now know a good, we now know a friend. He has a friend named Chira. Why we need to know the friend's name? Not necessarily so clear to us. Vayar sham Yehuda bat ish Knani ushmo Shua. He saw the daughter of a man whose name is Shua. Oh, now we know who that is. Vayikachel vayavo Ela. And we now know his friend, we know his father-in-law's name. Do we know his wife's name? No, not necessarily, unless it's like Bat Sheva, and eventually she'll be called Bat Shua. Could be. But the Torah certainly doesn't go out of its way as normally to tell us the person's name. And then she gave birth, she had a son, Er and Onan, and we know that because of their transgressions, both Er and Onan died. But Shelah is born in Pasuk Dala. Take a look, please, at the next underlying piece. V'haya b'chzi b'lita oto. The Torah tells us something which is clearly a very important thing for me to know, that when Shelah was born, Yehuda was in Kiziv. I ask you, who cares where Yehuda was when Shelah was born? Answer, you better believe his wife did. But he was nowhere around at that birth. Point three. So we know who his friends are, we know who his father-in-law is. His wife, for all we know, is right now, hey you. We see that he's not there at the birth of a child. Now, of course, it can happen, in defense of husbands everywhere, it can happen, all right, that you're not, by the way, and it has happened many times, that I'm not where I'm supposed to be when I'm supposed to be there, all right. But the fact that the Torah would tell us this, of all, all we ever see in the Torah is snippets of people's lives. Sarai Menu speaks twice, I think, in all of the Torah, twice. Surely she spoke more than twice. So we see snippets in their lives, and so this little snippet seems to be important. But we don't know why. I would submit to you that this is Exhibit C in a life that is self-absorbed. Now, we go ahead and then, of course, he tells Tamar briefly. He tells Tamar, "I want you to wait till Shelah grows up." Well, that may or may not be Exhibit D, because in fact, in those days, that's what people did. They waited, and of course there's a question of Yibum, and everybody died without having a child, so therefore that would be not so terribly unusual to expect. But let's go down to the next double underline. Vayirbu ayamim, but long time passed. All right? Vatamot bat Shua Eshet Yuda. She dies, his wife dies, whose name we really don't know. Maybe her name was Bat Shua. But Vayinachem Yehuda, double line. I'd like you to note the difference that we find in this parak between the response of Yaakov to the death of his son. With Yaakov, it says, Vayma'en lehitnachem. There was nothing they could do to bring him comfort. Nothing. Yehuda, his wife dies, Vayinachem Yehuda. Not Vayitabel Yehuda. Now we find that very... Vayinachem, he got over it. Got over it. Vayinachem Yehuda. And then he went, of course, he got over it apparently very well, to the point that that when he went out to shear sheep, and Tamar sees that he is going, and she realizes that chances are she's not going to see the fulfillment of his promise or the mitzvah unless she intervenes in some way. So she dresses up in such a way that she appears to be a zona, she appears to be a prostitute. Next line, Vayirel Yehuda Vayachshavel Zona. Now, of course, one of the other things we have to think about is despite the physical disguise, it would seem that it would be very hard for him not to know who she was. But he doesn't. Vayomer maha ha'iravon asher etenlach. What shall I give you? I didn't plan on this little encounter here. So I'm really caught short of cash. So what can I do? So he says, what the Eravon, what guarantee can I give you so that you will that you will provide your services? And so she says, Chotamcha uftilecha umatcha sher yadecha, your seal and your special twine and your stick, which clearly bears your mark on it. I'll take that. He does, and they obviously live together. Vayoshev el Yehuda, sleep together. Vayoshev el Yehuda, Vayoshev el Yehuda, Vayomer lo mitzatiah. He goes back. Now he has to pay. First of all, he wants his credit card back. He wants to get the stuff back. So he sends out his good friend Chiroi, sends him out and says, go find this person. And he says, lo mitzatiah, I have not found her. Once again, by the way, we find the Zot Matsanu, the brothers say, and he says, Lo Mitzati, I did not find her, I never found her. And then Yehuda says something very strange in the next pasuk. Vayomer Yehuda, Tikach la pen liyel avuz. Go back again. You've got to find her. Not because I owe her anything or anything of that nature, but after all, we'll be the laughing stock here. I've got to worry about my reputation. I've got to worry about me. Then we're going to go on. He goes back. Okay, now, this still doesn't find her. And then, of course, she has become pregnant. 3 months pass, right? And she becomes pregnant. I mean, she was pregnant, and now she begins to show. And then Yehuda gets the report about Tamar. Vayomer Yehuda, when he finds out, and they say, V'hinei hara liznunim, she was errant in the way that she conducted herself. What is Yehuda's response? Hotziyu avet Yisrael. Take her out and burn her. No defense, no thought, maybe, God forbid, she was violated. No thought that maybe some, who knows what may have happened. Nothing. Two words. Hotziyu avet. Now, by the way, we're not talking about just anybody. She was the wife of his first son, of his second son. He had intentions of third son. And the only thing he can respond, the Torah tells us, is take her out and burn her. No thought of who this person is. Again, that she was the Tamar that you and I recognize, maybe that I can understand. But it wouldn't matter anybody. Even here, we find people that are accused of crimes. We don't say, Hotziyem. The Yisarfu, trial, something. After all, perhaps who knows what was going through his mind, but it certainly wasn't justice. And then she was taken out, and she sent to her father-in-law, saying, Le'ish asher eile lo anochi hara. To the one who owns these, I am pregnant. Vatomer Hakerna. She says to him, identify these, please. The Medrash takes note of that. I can make no claim. The Medrash takes note. What's the difference between the first Hakerna and the second Hakerna? The first Hakerna was to conceal the truth. The second Hakerna is to reveal the truth. Same words. Totally different motivations. And so there we see that she, within two words, Hakerna, she now, and this, ladies and gentlemen, is the turning point of Yehuda's life. He realizes that the self-absorbed life that he had lived regarding his father, regarding his brothers, regarding his wife, regarding his daughter-in-law, regarding his sons, it doesn't even say he mourned his sons. He finally realizes there is someone who is willing to die rather than to expose and to humiliate another person. And by the way, that seemed to be his whole motivation all along. Now the next word, if you'll note carefully, the double underlined word on the bottom line. Vayaker Yehuda. Where do we have Vayaker before? We have Haker na Hakena. Where do we have Vayaker again before? Yaakov sees the coat. And what does the Torah tell us there? Vayakira. He recognized it. He recognized what's the it? The coat. Here it says Vayaker Yehuda. There is no limiting. There is no limiting suffix here. Yehuda's understanding now was not limited to the psil, to the chotemet, to the makel, to the fact that he was the one who had done what he did. He now, Vayaker Yehuda, means he now has an understanding of who he is, who he has been, and how shameful he has acted. Vayaker. Not he recognized it, but it was a self-recognition of all that had to change. And this is what the altar would have said. It's at this moment there is a change not for the better. There is not just the tshuva of becoming better. It is a tshuva of change. Yehuda is no longer the saved man. And he begins by saying two words, tzadka mimani. And even though those words are subject to various different interpretations, the simplest interpretation is, she is greater than I. I was so self-absorbed. I saw in myself greatness, and now I see in her even greater knowledge. Okay? Now, I'm going to pass up the interesting usage of the word yad in the interest of time, because I want to go to two other elements. But you can see from this moment the transformation of Yehuda is complete. Who is the person who convinces Yaakov to send his son Binyamin down to Mitzrayim, despite the terrible risk and fear, unbelievable fear that Yaakov must have had. No wife, lost his first son, and now he's got to give up the second son from that wife, the last vestige and remnant of that love of his life. And what does Yehuda say? Anochi e'eruven. Again, here we go, eravon. That very guarantee that he had given to Tamar was that which stayed with him forever. What a guarantee can mean, what it means to put yourself on the line. There he was just putting his property on the line, but he says, now, Anochi ervenu, I will be the guarantor. Miyadi, from my hand, to Vakshenu. And then finally, he's almost there. Right now, he's better, as the Alter would say. But the next pasuk, the next selection, it shows exactly what he is. He is not just better. He is no longer the Yehuda of his early life. Because if you look at the next piece, Bereshit Mem Daled, Ki Avdecha Ahav Et Hanar, your servant has guaranteed this child's safe return. V'ata Yeshev Na Avdecha Tachat Hanar. Now take me in place of the child. Eved L'Adoni. I am willing to give up my whole identity and being. That's what an Eved is. His identity is transformed from him to the master. So we move now. Now it is complete.
It is no longer Yehuda the better. It is now Yehuda the changed. He says, and he says, Tachat Hanar Eved Ladoni. And therefore he says, Ki Eich Ere. How shall I ever, Elavi, Vanar Enenuiti, Pen Ere Do Vara Asher Yimza Et Avi. I can't bear that. And therefore, take me. So Yehuda's transition is complete. Now, that's Yehuda. Yehuda had a descendant, David HaMelech. David HaMelech is the Baal Tshuva. As a matter of fact, again, each of these, of course, is a shiur in and of itself, but the story of... just like Yehuda and Tamar is a story in and of itself, and maybe a series of shiurim in and of themselves. So also, of course, David and Bathsheba is similarly so. And I don't want to go into whether David sinned. The Gemara tells us that whoever says that David sinned is only making a mistake. By the way, parenthetically, this is one of those serendipity types of things. I happen to be learning a parshan. The Akedat Yitzchak, not at all on this parsha, not at all on Yehuda and Tamar, not at all on the story of David, etc. But he of all places, Sefer Parshat Bamidbar, he writes his interpretation of Kol Omer Chata David. Whoever says that David sinned is only making a mistake. He said Kol Omer Chata David. Whoever spends his life saying yeah, but David did it, Eino Elatoa. His life's a fraud. How often we all say, yeah, but look who did it. He did it. Now, I am certain that's not what the Gemara meant. All right? But nevertheless, it is sometimes, even if the Gemara doesn't mean something, or if it's a good lesson for all of us, whoever spends his life saying, yeah, but look what this president did, and look what this person did, and look what that person did, their whole life will be a fraud. But David... at some level, whether you take the Malbim's position that there was no actual physical halachic sin, or you take Abravanel's position that in fact David was a man who was had as great as he was, he had those frailties. His greatness was matched very often by his frailties. So then we can see that you can look at it either way, but in either case, he failed to meet his own standards. That's absolute. And again, I don't want to get into what exactly those standards were or not, but I just want to point out a couple of things about Perek Nun Aleph, because I want to make sure that I stay within the time frame. David HaMelech in Perek Nun Aleph of Tehillim, this is Tehillim Nun Aleph, does something that no one else that I doubt we would find. Was it John Edwards, after years of browbeating and everything else? So he came out and with this confession. Nobody ever browbeat David HaMelech into anything. If he didn't want to write anything, he didn't write anything. And if anybody contested that he didn't write anything, that could well have been their last contesting. He was the Melech. Could have done what he wanted. Yet he sits down on some magnificent evening, as the Chazal tell us, that he had his own alarm clock. The wind of Yerushalayim would wake him up at midnight. And after that alarm clock woke him up, and he did his tikkun chatzot, whatever it is that he did, and he sat down and he wrote. So one night he felt, I have to write for all time. And when he wrote, he didn't write for himself. It wasn't his personal diary. He wrote for you and me because we're free. And he writes, L'manatzeach mizmor l'David, bevo elav natan anavi kasher ba el Bathsheba. I always found it stunning that David HaMelech, who was the master of words, would write, Bevoi love, Natana Navi. Okay, so he's recounting Natan, as you know. David slept with Bathsheba. He sent Uriah to the front. He had him killed. All right, at least he put him in a situation just like the brothers. Whether they sold Yosef or not is secondary. They put him in the complete position of being killed or sold. And so certainly David HaMelech placed Uriah, whether with halachic justification or without that halachic justification, David himself, it seems clear, felt that he had done wrong. So, but, and Natananavi comes in and gives him the famous story of the to the rich man and the poor man. The rich man has all everything that he wants. The poor man has one little shepsele. He's got one little lamb, right? And that lamb, he nurtures the lamb and he loves the lamb. What is and the company comes to the rich man. He takes the poor man's lamb. What do you say? And David HaMelech says that this person ben mavet Aisha say. He deserves death. To steal from the poor people, he deals it. And what does and once again, two words. Notice, you know, hotziyav v'tisaref. I was thinking you could almost make a doctoral thesis of pithy two-word sayings in Tanakh, right? Hotziyav v'tisaref. We learned already, right? Tzadikam mimeni, Yehuda says. And what does Natan say to David, the man who holds everybody's life in his hands? Atavish, you are that. And until now, you refuse to recognize it. Now you need to know. Atahaish. Right? So, look what David writes. Bevo elav natan anavi kasher ba el batsheva. Such bland verbs. I dare say at Ida Crown Jewish Academy, where they do very well in English, he may not well have, he would have gotten a couple of red marks saying, go back, find a different word, find a better word. I would submit to you that if my... I would have to submit to my teacher, right? That word is perfect. It is perfect because the word ba usually means in biblical Hebrew the passion of a sexual interchange. Bevo elav natan anavi kasher ba el batsheva. With the same passion that David HaMelech came to Batsheva, that's the passion Natan came to him. A passion, and what is passion? Passion, by and large, is you see nothing else but what is in front of you. You think of nothing else but what is in front of you. And that's a Navi in general. Right? That same passion. He had to, because unless he could meet David HaMelech's passion, in this case to do wrong, with what to do right, he might not have succeeded. And I merely want to point out just a couple things, because I want to get to the third of our transformations. David HaMelech writes, V'chatati negdi tamid. He writes here that when he talks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and of course, in this parak, I would urge you to look at this parak when you go home. Look, you will see that it has all the elements of tshuva in it. Right? Charata ala avar. It has the sense of pain and agony of what he had done. And vidui. This is the entire parak is vidui, of an expression of confession and of admission to what he has done. And then, of course, it has also the element of Kabbalah latid. We're going to see that in a moment. But notice what David writes, V'chatati negdi tamid. My sin is in front of me always. Where else do we have a phrase similar to that? In shuls all over the world? Shiviti Hashem negdi tamid. David HaMelech, who wrote in Perek, I think, I have down that Perek at Zion. If you look down at the bottom, Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. You want to know the secret to my greatness, says David HaMelech? Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. I am aware. My awareness is always there. And so therefore, he says, but you want to know something? As great as a person can be, if I was capable of keep Hashem constantly in front of me when I did slip, and ve'enish tzadik baratz asher yaseh tov v'lo yechta, no one is free of wrongdoing. What happened is that I took Hashem away from me, constantly being my awareness of God, and then David HaMelech, because he was David HaMelech, most of us move on, right? Do something wrong, let's move on. V'chatati negdi tamid. With the same exact intensity that he had placed HaKadosh Baruch Hu before him, now he can't get the chait out of his mind. They say about the Vilna Gaon that somebody once asked the Vilna Gaon, what is it like to have an absolutely photographic memory, which among other things, it wasn't just the photographic memory. He says, it obviously works to my advantage very much. He said, but I also can't get a light post out of my head for 2 weeks. So the light, there it is. He saw a sign, go to, this way to Vilna. He can't get out of his head, right? He has to deal with that too. That, you know, there is no such thing that only has an upside. Everything has its downside too. That's how we deal with the downsides that are the issues. As by the way, the Netziv says, Yivorecha Hashem v'yishmerecha. What is it? May Hashem bless you, ushmerecha, and keep you, as we say. So says the Netziv, Yivarechecha Hashem, may Hashem bless you, v'yishmerecha, and protect you from the blessing. Because every blessing has within it an inherent curse. If a person is beautiful, vanity follows. A person is intelligent, he begins to think that he knows everything. A person is blessed with great wealth, he can misuse the wealth. Yivarechecha Hashem, v'yishmerecha. No one in history, perhaps, was blessed as David HaMelech was blessed. He needed a special shmira from the bracha, perhaps. Now, and so he, but if you look at Nun Aleph, you see the expressions, and I actually indicated where, at what point David has Kabbalah Latid. It's in Pasuk Ted Vav, right? Alamda poshim drachecha. I will teach. This is, as they say now, this is his Kabbalah. Right? What is his Kabbalah al-Asif? Alamda poshim drachecha. V'chataim eilecha yashuv. Here's how I'm going to make it better. I can't change what happens. Uri is not coming back. And my life, and that has to stay with me. But I can work on transformation. I can change, not just become better. Alamada poshim derechecha. David HaMelech becomes the great teacher of Klal Yisrael. This is David, Natan's coming to him and his decision to teach all of the Jewish people for all time about tshuva. That is his turning point. I would like to end this one segment on David on the second page with a quote from Abravanel, not necessarily to weigh in on one side or the other of the argument, although Abravanel is very clear about where he stands. And you're going to see it here, but I'm not bringing it because of that. I hope some of you believe me. All right. Sof Davar. In the end, he gives a long analysis. By the way, for Abravanel, there were no short analyses. Sof Davar. Im hakatuv kira'o choter, if the pasuk called him a sinner, v'hu hoda cheto, and in Tehillim Nun Aleph, he admitted he did wrong, echayato e'adam b'hamino. How could we say, eno elatoa, that anybody who says David did wrong is errant in his thinking? How could he say that's a Abravanel's position? Believe me, there are responses to that. But I actually cite it more for the next two lines. Tovli, he says, it's more satisfying for me, and I believe he means spiritually, ethically. Sheomar, that I should say, shechatam od, he did a terrible, grievous sin. Vehodam od, but his tshuva was equal to the sin. Veshav b'tshuvato gemura, extra tough, sorry. Veshav b'tshuva gemura v'kibel onsho. His tshuva was complete. He was changed. He was not just better, he was changed. Uvazeh nitkapru avonotav. Turning point number two. The third one's going to be a little short. Moshe Rabbeinu, because we are, of course, in still these stunning parshiot of Shmot. Moshe Rabbeinu needs... as Rabbi Brand said, Moshe Rabbeinu needs no introduction at all. He's well known to everybody. And, but he goes out, the Torah tells us, of course, we know about his birth, and we find out that he is, in fact, taken into Bat Paro's house, and there he lives. We don't know exactly, don't know for sure how long, but he lived for a long time. We also know through the Medrash that not only did his mother nurture him by nursing him, but then he was also, under the table, he was taught about his Jewish heritage. So picture, if you will, for a moment, a person who has grown up in the palace of the king. And I was never in a palace, at least that was occupied. Ancient palaces in Europe, you get it. But I was once right next to a palace in Morocco. And I got to tell you, just so you understand what a palace is, it's not this thing, that's not... It is a complex. It is an entire complex where it could be a city in and of itself. Yeah, they live in splendid isolation. Whoever lives there, the king can be as isolated and queen as isolated as they want to be. All right. So I assume that probably Paro, being the king of and the greatest ruler of his time, would have had such a palace. And Moshe's living there in splendid isolation, knowing that he's a Jew and feeling certainly a sense of Jewishness. But then number two, knowing also that. He has a great deal of fondness for the Egyptian culture. And it's in this context we have this pasuk. Vayhi vayamim ahem, and it was in those days, vayidal Moshe vayitzei alechav.
Moshe Rabbeinu went out to his brothers.
Question, who are the brothers? What? The Jews. He went out to see the Jews. Okay. Vayar b'sivlotam, and we can support that because we can interpret it this way. He went out and he saw their suffering. Notice the word vayar. Not all seeing is the exact same thing. We won't go into that now, but not all seeing is the exact same thing. Vayar appears three times here. I'm not so sure that any one of them is the same as the other. Vayar ish mitzri. What did he see? An Egyptian man, makeh ish ivri me'echav, from his brothers. Now, if the first echav is the Jews, what would the second one be? Also the Jews. And why would we need that the second time? It could be, if you look down to Rabbeinu ibn Ezra, at least this, some people contest this. They feel that he didn't, that this is a mistake. But nevertheless, I'd like to deal with that mistake because I think that it certainly is instructive for us. Vayetze Yalachav Hamitzrim. He says he went out to his brothers. It wasn't the Jews. He went out to the Mitzrim. So you have a question. What does it mean? Vayar b'sivlotam. He saw their suffering. Well, and that would seem to be the Jews. And if that's the case, how does it fit? The answer is, we had in the subsequent parshiot, Tachat Sivlot Mitzrayim. Sivlot Mitzrayim means the pain they inflicted, not necessarily that was inflicted on them. It could be either. All right? But in this case, Rabbeinu ibn Ezra says, Amitzri, he went out to the Mitzrim, Ki ba'armona melechaya. He lived in the king's palace. He lived in splendid isolation. His brothers were the people that he tangibly knew. He saw on a daily basis. Those are his brothers. Intellectually, culturally, yeah, he's a Jew. All right? The second me'echav, he says, clearly must be from his genetic family, meaning to say from the Jews. That's Adkani ben Ezra. So I'd like to suggest to you the following. Let's accept the Rabbeinu ibn Ezra's position. All right? He goes out and he thinks he's living in a world that is ideal. It is ideal. He's living in a world of the greatest culture of its time, Egypt. And he's living, and he's also a Jew. He feels very good about that. His mother, his sister, who knows, taught him. So he feels good. And he when he walks out, he believes we have two worlds that can coexist perfectly together. But then he's taken for a rude awakening. Vayar, Vayetze Elachav to his brothers, the Egyptians, he wants to see how things are going. After all, we live in an ideal world. I want to see how an ideal society functions. And what does he see? Vayar ish mitzri makeh ish ivri. What does he see? Merciless beating. Uncontrollable. Achzariyut. Merciless. And he realizes, wait a minute. It's not that we have two worlds and I can see a little piece of each. These worlds are mutually exclusive. These cultures are mutually exclusive. One is based upon what my mother told me, and the other is based upon what I see. And so therefore, and with this we're going to conclude, it says, Moshe Rabbeinu now has a decision to make. This is purely midrashic on my part. Vayifen kovacho. He looked at his Jewish side, and he looked at his Egyptian side. Vayar ki enish. He saw he had no identity. The identity that he thought he had, that two cultures can coexist perfectly, he realizes is not there. And then what must he do? Vayachat HaMitzri. At that moment, he had to decide to kill the Egyptian within him. And of course, each and every one of us has to decide. We know we live in this blessed, wonderful, beautiful land of ours, and indeed it is so. And there, in other words, certainly we are so far different, but every one of us needs to think at one point or another, what is the mitzri within me? What is that which is culturally antithetical to my being Jewish? What is that antithetical? Whether it's an ethical issue or whether it's association identity issue, I need to think it through. Each of us must at one point or another kill something of the mitzri. Certainly to retain that which is beautiful and wonderful in this blessed land, or in any, certainly in this land, but nevertheless, the lessons of Moshe Rabbeinu, knowing that at some point or another we must establish our identity, and sometimes it involves Vayachet HaMitzri. David HaMelech, who is willing to literally subject himself to the scrutiny of all time, of what he had done, But in order to do tshuva, he said, Alamda, I will teach. Nevertheless, I will teach, even if it hurts me. And Yehuda, who was willing to look at himself, but he needed the figure of Tamar to transform him, in fact, was transformed. Tshuva is not only becoming better, it is becoming changed.
On behalf of all of us in the Kohler, I'd like to thank Rabbi Myers. We're going to take a 2-minute break, and then we'll reconvene with Rabbi Angel. Right.